Well, good evening, everyone. It's great to be back. Tonight we hopefully will finish up the short project on the subject of euthanasia, suicide, mercy killing. We've looked at a number of considerations, and tonight we're going to try to deal with the biblical matter of how did King Saul die, and then try to apply some of the things that we have looked at in our research regarding suicide and assisted suicide and euthanasia and all of these issues as we apply it to this case. If you would, First Samuel, we've read the passage before, so we won't, for time's sake, read it all. But if you'll note in verses 1 and 2, we have the war between the Philistines and Israel. And the Israelites are being defeated. And Saul is about to go to his death, that is King Saul, along with three of his sons, and one of them being Jonathan, a good friend with David. And Saul is going to die here in this scene, and then David will take his place as king. And if you remember, perhaps when Saul was chosen to be the king, that he was a man of tall stature, and that he was said that his head was above all the others in the land, tall man. Evidently a well-built man. He's going to lose that head. His enemies are going to cut off his head. And his pride is certainly going to be humbled. Let's pick up in verse 3. The battle went sore against Saul, and the archers hit him, and he was sore wounded or severely wounded of the archers. Then said Saul unto his armor-bearer, Draw thy sword and thrust me through therewith, lest these uncircumcised come and thrust me through and abuse me. That is, he seems concerned about being tortured here and being humiliated. But his armor-bearer would not, for he was sore afraid. Therefore Saul took a sword and fell upon it. And when his armor-bearer saw that Saul was dead, he fell likewise upon his sword and died with him. So Saul died, and his three sons and his armor-bearer and all his men that same day together. It's quite a loss of Saul's armor, or rather his army. And when the men of Israel saw that were on the other side of the valley, and they that were on the other side of Jordan saw that the men of Israel fled, and that Saul and his sons were dead, they forsook the cities and fled, and the Philistines came and dwelt in them. It came to pass on the morrow, when the Philistines came to strip the slain, they found Saul and his three sons fallen in Mount Gibeah, and they cut off his head, stripped off his armor, and sent into the land of the Philistines round about to publish it in the house of their idols and among the people. And they put his armor in the house of Ashtaroth, and they fastened his body to the wall of Bethshan. When the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead heard of that which the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men arose and went all night and took his body, the body of Saul, and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Bashan, and came to Jabesh and burnt them there. And they took their bones and buried them under a tree at Jabesh and fasted 7 days. Note here is that this is a very uncommon way to handle the bodies of the dead in Israel. That is burning them. But evidently the state of the bodies by this time have become so decayed that they felt this was the best thing to do. And so they destroyed them by fire, and yet still had the bones left, and evidently they did not want the Philistines to get a hold of them, lest that they make mockery out of them. So they took them and buried them here in Jabesh, and then they mourned for 7 days. Now then, let's turn to 2 Samuel chapter 1, and here we have another account of this incident, and we've got to try to work these things through and see what's going on here. We don't know who wrote 1 Samuel as such, but the writer describes the manner of Saul's death in a way that is at variance of what we're going to read here in 2 Samuel. We read, "It came to pass after the death of Saul, when David was returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, and David had abode 2 days in Ziklag. It came even to pass on the third day that, behold, a man came out of the camp from Saul with his clothes rent, and earth upon his head. So it was, when he came to David, that he fell to the earth and did obeisance." That is, he's acknowledging David to be the king that's going to replace Saul. "David said unto him, From whence comest thou? And he said unto him, Out of the camp of Israel am I escaped. And David said unto him, How went the matter? How did the battle go? I pray thee, tell me. And he answered, That the people are fled from the battle, and many of the people also are fallen and dead, and Saul and Jonathan his son are dead also. And David said to the young one, to the young man that told him, How knowest thou, or how do you know, that Saul and Jonathan his son be dead? And the young man that told him said, As I happened by chance upon Mount Gilboa, just passing through there, that scene, behold, Saul leaned upon his spear, and lo, the chariots and horsemen followed hard after him. And when he looked behind him, he saw me, and called unto me, and I answered, Here am I. And he said unto me, Who art thou? And I answered him, I'm an Amalekite." You remember back when God commanded Saul to do something back at the start of his kingship? What was that? Anybody recall your history? You remember that the command from God was to wipe out all the Amalekites, and Saul spared, who was it? I forget the name of one of the important leaders, and kept some of the sheep. Now then, he's going to die in a battle here. He's going to be humiliated. And then there's going to be an Amalekite who's going to try to rise up and take a part in the new administration. It's best to do what God says to do and do it thoroughly. If you don't get rid of sin, it'll come back to haunt you. You play with it here and there, and you think you can serve God halfway and not do all that he says to do, it'll come back down the road somewhere. He said unto me, Who art thou? I answered him, I'm an Amalekite. He said unto me again, Stand, I pray thee, upon me and slay me, for anguish is come upon me, because my life is yet whole in me. So I stood upon him and slew him, because I was sure that he could not live after that he was fallen. I took the crown that was upon his head and the bracelet that was on his arm, and have brought them hither unto my Lord. You see, he's acknowledging David to be the one who's the new king, the new government in place. And he thinks here that if he shows that he has participated in the finalization of the old administration, being Saul, that David will think kindly upon him for putting Saul out of the picture. Verse 11, then David took hold on his clothes and rent them, and likewise all the men that were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and Jonathan his son, and for the people of the Lord, for the house of Israel, because they were fallen by the sword. That is the army that is taking place here. How many of you can recall back in the history of David and Saul, were there not times in that history in which that Saul tried to kill David? And were there not times in which David had the opportunity to take the life of Saul? But why wouldn't he do so?
Because he was the anointed one.
He was the anointed one of God. And even though he'd been told that he was going to be the next king, he refused to take out any type of animosity upon Saul, because Saul was the one God had put in place. And he would wait for God's providence to remove Saul. He would not consider himself to be an instrument of overthrowing Saul.
God's law requires attempted murderers to be executed just as well as murder, you know.
What's that?
God's law required that attempted murder, a person that attempts murder, is to be executed just like one that does commit murder.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So why would Saul not be a candidate for execution for trying to murder David?
Well, you have many of those laws that God gave that Israel never did implement them. Why wasn't David executed for committed adultery with Bathsheba?
Because God set it aside.
It's what?
Because God pardoned him and said it wasn't to be done.
Yeah, but the law, how would, if the law is on the books, David is the king. He's the judicial authority. And yet he wasn't executed. There were numerous laws relating to marriage and divorce that were not enforced. You find the laws relating to the stoning of the adulterer and the adulteress, many examples that they were not executed. It's on the books, but the judges of Israel never put them in force. And so I would answer the question in that light right there. That was the book. That's what the law said to do. But it was not enforced all the time. And that is consistently. All right. So they're mourning now here. And David is mourning for Saul. And he's mourning for Jonathan. And we read in verse 13, and David said unto the young man that told him, whence art thou, or who are you? He answered, I am the son of a stranger, an Amalekite. And David said unto him, how wast thou not afraid to stretch forth thine hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? Here we're getting to the heart of it now. Here he's coming thinking that he has done David a favor. For David could have done that a long time ago for his removing Saul. But now then you can just start to see this young man's countenance start to fall when David raises that question. He's standing there thinking, I'm ready to get my reward. You killed Saul. How do you think to take upon yourself to take the life of the Lord's anointed? Now that probably will help us in dealing why the armor bearer, see, refused to kill Saul or to take his life, and Saul requested him to do so. The armor bearer even refused to do it. And would that not be a point of wisdom if you were the armor bearer? Word gets back to David that you killed Saul or helped him to die, why, you know what's going to happen in taking the life of God's anointed. Verse 15. David called one of the young men and said, "Go near and fall upon him," and he smote him that he died. Boy, that's swift justice here. That's swift. They didn't take that on the books and wait 6 months or 5 years for the death penalty to be decided upon and executed. This was swift. David said unto him, "Thy blood be upon thy head, for thy mouth hath testified against thee, saying, I have slain the Lord's anointed." And David lamented with his lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan, his son. Now then, before we read another passage here, we want to try to deal with the two different descriptions here. Who is telling the truth? Is it the narrator who is recording the record in 1 Samuel, or is it the young Amalekite who has come before David? Which one of these is describing the correct incident as to how King Saul died?
He wasn't the Amalekite's king.
Yeah. This young man is an Amalekite. He is a Gentile. And the Amalekites are under the curse of God to have them all wiped out. And he knows that. And he knows that now then here's a new administration. And his only hope of being spared under the new king is to get into good favor with the king. And so he's coming and saying, "This is what I've done for you, David. I have gotten rid of the former administration. And now then, what can you do for me?" That's the story that he comes bringing. So we have to decide whether or not he's telling the truth even. And why does David put him to death if he is telling the truth? Or which one of these accounts is the correct one? Because there can only be one correct one, because they're conflicting accounts in 1 Samuel 31 and 2 Samuel 1. There's a contradiction, and we know that we cannot have a contradiction within the Word of God. Now, there have been attempts at harmonizing the two accounts, but the efforts that have been attempted always seem to fall short of being convincing. For example, as early as the first century, Josephus, the noted Jewish historian, tried to make the accounts fit with each other or to harmonize. And in his book on the Antiquities of the Jews, he claimed that after Saul's armor bearer refused to kill Saul, that Saul tried to fall on his own sword, but he was too weak to do so. So Saul then turned and saw this Amalekite, who upon the king's request, Saul's request, complied and killed him. That is, having found the king leaning on his sword, but could not finish the act of taking his own life. So Saul says, "The armor bearer won't do it. Now then, would you do it?" And so the Amalekite then says, "Yes, I'll do it." So Josephus tries to fit the harmony of it there. So then afterward, the Amalekite takes the king's crown and armband and flees, whereupon Saul's armor bearer killed himself. Now, while everything seems to fit in this harmonization, there's one fact that is out of line, and that's the armor bearer. The armor bearer was sufficiently convinced of Saul's death before he took his own life. So this does not allow for the Amalekite to come into the picture and finish Saul off. The armor bearer is convinced that Saul is dead, and then he takes his own life. The Amalekite is saying is that Saul was still alive when I arrived on the scene. It won't fit. That is the testimony of the Amalekite. And thus, Josephus' greatest mistake was in trusting the story of the Amalekite. Also, it's most improbable that the Amalekite found Saul leaning on his sword, an unlikely sequel of a botched attempt of suicide. Highly unlikely. So then, what is the proper conclusion as to how these accounts are given? And I take the position that the Amalekite is lying. He's lying about the whole account, that he has arrived on the scene after everybody's dead, and he takes the armor and the crown from Saul. Now you may say, well, don't the Philistines do that? They may take the clothing. Same description. But this Amalekite takes the armor and he brings it to David and says, I've done this for you. Now then, what is my reward? And David picks up on something here. And he somehow, in his own discernment, sees that the Amalekite is not telling the truth, and that he is trying to use this as an example or an attempt to get in good with him, that is David, in order that he might be spared himself and promoted under the new kingdom of Israel. Now look over in 2 Samuel chapter 4. And here we have the murder of Ish-bosheth, and look in verse 8, and we have a statement here that will help us understand this. Verse 7, when they came into his house, he lay on his bed in his bedchamber, and they smote him and slew him and beheaded him and took his head and gat them away through the plain all night. And they brought the head of Ish-bosheth unto David, to Hebron, and said to the king, behold, the head of Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul. See, here's another descendant of Saul, another one of Saul's sons. Thine enemy, which sought thy life. See that description in there? Which sought your life. Here's your enemies. Incidentally, I stop here in reading that it was very customary in the Old Testament era that when you're dealing with kings, you're dealing with dynasties. That is, offspring. When the father dies, one of the sons becomes the next king. If a new administration comes in and overthrows the kingdom, they do not allow any possibility for an insurrection. An insurgency, if you please. They eradicate all and kill all the descendants of the king so that nobody else can rise up and overthrow the new administration. And this is still going on here. Some of his sons are dead, and now then they're taking the life of another one. And they're thinking this is going to please David. Reading again, the son of Saul, thine enemy, which sought thy life, and the Lord hath avenged my Lord the king this day of Saul and of his seed. See, we've got you all taken care of now, David. Nobody is going to be, the kingdom is not going to return to the lineage of Saul. Now look how David responds. And David answered Rechab and Baana, his brother, the sons of Ramon the Berethite, and said unto them, as the Lord liveth, who hath redeemed my soul out of all adversity. Now watch carefully. He's going to give an illustration here. when one told me, saying, Behold, Saul is dead, thinking to have brought good tidings, I took hold of him and slew him in Ziklag, who thought that I would have given him a what?
Reward.
A reward for his tidings. Now he's talking about the Amalekite here. How much more, when wicked men have slain a righteous person in his own house upon his bed, shall I not therefore now require his blood of your hand and take you away from the earth? And David commanded his young men, and they slew them and cut off their hands and their feet and hanged them up over the pool in Hebron. But they took the head of Ishbosheth and buried it in the sepulcher of Abner in Hebron. Is this not the explanation? David said, I picked up on that young man, that Amalekite, when he come into my presence. I saw that he was lying, that he only wanted this, to do this in order to get a reward from me for doing so. He said, I had him executed. And now then, you fellows come in here and you bring me the head of Saul's, another one of Saul's son, and you expect me to reward you? I'm going to reward you the same way I rewarded the Amalekite. So I think if you take this in its context, Brother Jim, that you have the explanation here, is that the correct description of how Saul died is in 1 Samuel. And 2 Samuel chapter 1 is the story of a lying Amalekite who's not telling the truth. Any questions regarding that?
Was the Amalekite, you said he was a Gentile.
Yeah.
Was he fighting with the Philistines? Was he a soldier or just...
No, he just happens to... He says, I arrived on the scene here of this battle between Israel and the Philistines. Now, it wasn't that the Israelites had never been battling with the Amalekites. They were their enemies as well. But he just... And he knows that, this young man. And he knows that if David comes on the scene and he does what the Lord told Saul to do, and that's annihilate the Amalekites, then he knows that it's going to be, his life's going to be in danger as long as he's alive, is that he's under the curse of Israel. And so I think David picks up on this, and he said, this fellow is trying to use this to get in good with me, to spare his own life. And yet he dares to say that he takes the life of God's anointed. He didn't do it, but he says, I would dare to do so. And David said, because you would even dare to do so, I now will take your life. All right, any other questions in regard to that? Then let's look at some of the issues involved here relating to this. Saul, then, is seriously, if not mortally or fatally, wounded. That is, the arrows didn't kill him, but he's seriously wounded. And his enemies are coming, and he does not want to be abused or tortured. So he asks his armor bearer to finish him off. If the armor bearer had done so, what would that have been in our study?
Assisted suicide.
Assisted suicide. You see? Is that here is an individual who comes and finishes off the patient who is wounded. Now, the armor bearer refuses to do so. For what reason?
Mason.
Yeah, and if David gets wind of that, then he's going to take his own life. I'm not going to do this. Now, here's a man that's suffering. He's asking to be put out of his misery. And the enemy's going to come, and they're probably going to cut out his eyes and torture him and things of that nature. So he asks for his armor bearer to finish him off. The armor bearer refuses to assist in the matter. And since the Amalekite is not telling the truth, then we take the account in 1 Samuel as the correct one, that Saul then hastens his own demise by falling upon his sword. However that is done, I don't know, Jim or any others know how that is actually done.
I believe I sword or spear in the ground and then fall off.
The,
so it would have hit
the
weight of the body.
The handle somehow and try to press it through you like that. Mm-hmm. Okay. What would this then describe Saul as doing? All right, he's taking his life. That appears to be the picture that is there. The Amalekite, if he had really done what he said he had done, then he would have been assisting, but actually he would have been participating in murder as well. Now that's all real neat, isn't it? That's the best that I can describe out of this. Anybody have any other input on the scenarios and what we've been studying here? But I've got something else I want to present to you. Anyone? What would be the difference between Saul falling on his sword and a person in one of those towers, a 911 jumping out the window? You're awful quiet. What would be the difference between Saul and what our sister, Verna Smith, we attended her sister's funeral, when was it?
Monday.
Huh?
Monday.
She had been for, I believe, I understand, several years on dialysis, having to go 3 times a week to have dialysis and have the family, one of the daughters, take her and get others pick her up. That had gone on for a number of years. The condition continued to deteriorate to where that her health was, she was just an absolute disarray with pain. She reached a point where she decided she wanted to be taken off of the machine. She asked the doctor how long she would live, and the doctor said somewhere between 2 and 4 weeks. And she died during that time period. Now, did she commit suicide? Did she hasten her life? You're awful quiet. Well, let me throw you out another one. Maybe you never think in these lines. Maybe you do. Did our Lord Jesus Christ commit suicide on the cross? Could he not have defended his life? He said, "No man takes it from me. I lay it down." Did he commit suicide on the cross? Boy, you're quiet this evening. Now, we can go a whole lot further. When we get, what I'm saying is that here we got the theory. But now we got all these individual different circumstances that have to enter in, and then we have to make the application of the theory in our own set of circumstances. That's why I'm saying that we can have it all figured out as to what we're going to do if we don't want to be kept alive on a respirator, or if our loved ones have said they don't want to be kept alive on a respirator. But when you get into that hospital room and it comes down to push and shove and you have to make the decision, do we keep life going or do we let life go? Which do you do? Who is playing God? Are we playing God if we hasten the death Or are we playing God if we do not do so? These are difficult questions.
I think Christ did this category of lifestyle. I don't think it fits as suicide or,
What about a soldier who throws his body on a grenade in the middle of a street in order to save his comrades? Did he commit suicide?
No.
You see? Why not, Clint?
Because he was not trying to kill himself. He was trying to save other people.
All right. Now you're getting close.
What if it was
free? I can't hear you. I don't hear well. I need to speak up now.
What if it's predestined?
If it's what?
Predestined that you're going to die at this time no matter what, even if you take out this circumstance, this circumstance, this circumstance. We were talking about it earlier.
Mm-hmm.
It's predestined. Something's going to happen to you.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you go back and change it or change it somehow, you're going to die here.
Yeah. All right. The question or the statement is, if something has been predestined to occur in reference to our death, then really what difference does it make in that? The answer to that is that the decrees of predestination belong into the secret knowledge and wisdom of God. We don't know what they are. We have to act according to the moral precepts and commandments of God. You recall that the death of Christ was predestined, and yet it says that men took him, and what kind of hands did they have?
Wicked
hands. They crucified the Lord of glory. They were responsible because they committed murder. So we are responsible for how we conduct and serve as stewards over our own life. We don't know what the predestinating purposes and decrees of God are for us. Philip?
I know this is just taking it a step further, but in that example, one of the high priests saw that Jesus was to die,
mm-hmm.
and yet it was still wrong for them to kill him.
Yeah.
Even though he knew that it was supposed to happen.
Yeah.
Just because
yes.
someone is supposed to die doesn't mean we're supposed to take their life.
Exactly. Well, the person who takes the life is morally accountable. So if a person commits suicide, that is under the predestinating decree of God, but they're still morally accountable for taking their own life. And that's called the responsibility of man and the sovereignty of God. Both of these are intertwined together. Thank you, Philip, and the question here. Any other?
Brother Jim, I don't believe that the people that had to make a choice at 9/11, I don't think they were contemplating any suicide. I think they had to make a choice of whether they wanted to burn or whether they wanted to end another way.
Yeah.
But they weren't thinking about committing suicide.
And that's the thing. There are circumstances in which that we do not have time to rationalize as to how what we're going to do. We just have to do it. There are times in which that God gives some individuals supernatural acts of physical strength to tear a car door off when there's somebody trapped inside the car. And all caution would err if you stood back and rationalized, I'm not going there. And yet they do that. And what they could not do in the normal sense, the time, they're enabled by God to do so in some instances. Now, Clint, what was it that I asked back there? And I said, we're getting right to the heart of it. The grenade incident. Here is, we're in a warfare or something of that nature, and a grenade is thrown out into the open, and there are other people's lives, soldiers there, and one soldier goes and throws himself upon it, and he's destroyed. Now, did he commit suicide?
No.
No. And why not?
Because he was not contemplating suicide. He wasn't trying to end his own life. He was trying to save his comrades' lives.
All right. Now, here I believe as we come to the answer as to whether you do this or that, is all contingent upon what your motive is. What is your motive for the action in which you take?
What if their motive is they're a burden to their family and their motive is to do away with this burden that they are on their family?
Okay. All right, here's a question. A person considers taking their life in order to not be a burden to the family. Would you have a response to that, anybody?
It's suicide.
All right, still suicide.
I think so.
Yeah. Okay, it's still the same thing. How would you counsel an individual who's thinking like that, though?
Has all the families told you that you need to get out of here?
The what?
Has all of the family told you to kill yourself?
Yeah.
So which is
going to bring on the biggest burden on the family? The person staying alive or the person killing himself? Is there going to be any harm done to the family if a person commits suicide?
Does it matter?
Hmm?
In our decision where to encourage her to commit suicide, we shouldn't consider the results either way, should we?
I missed that. Say it again.
I may have missed it.
All right, here, let's take some reasons why we should not commit suicide. What would be the highest reason?
Self-murder.
Yeah, but there's something else, though.
Violates the law of God.
Yes.
Sanctity of life.
But we're not, you can never say, I'm doing this for the glory of God. I'm going to kill myself for God's glory. Whatsoever you eat, drink, and do, do all for what? The glory of God. You cannot claim that you're going to take your own life and that God will be glorified in it. Because His Word has given us very clear commands. Thou shalt not kill, and suicide is one of those. All right, so it's going to affect God's honor and His character. Now, what else is it going to affect?
Your testimony.
Your testimony. Let's say you're a Christian. It's going to affect the cause of Christ. Okay, what else? Who else or what else is it going to affect?
Going to do tremendous psychological damage to family and friends.
Yeah.
I've seen it.
Yeah.
I've had several friends and acquaintances.
And that's what, back to your original question of, I maybe ought to consider committing suicide because I'm just a burden. But the other side of that coin is, it casts a tremendous psychological burden upon the surviving family members and friends. If I took my own life, it would affect the glory of God. If I took my own life, it would affect the cause of Christ, and particularly since I am a minister of the gospel. If I took my own life, it would affect my wife for the rest of her life. And it would affect my children and their grandchildren and their grandchildren for 3 and 4 generations to come. That would be known that I, as a gospel minister, took my own life. So there are tremendous ramifications for not committing suicide. And I think is the key of it is, Clint, what you touched on here, what's my motive for doing this? If you haven't read the book by Johnny Erickson Tada, A Right to Die, you ought to get yourself a copy of that. You know who I'm talking about? The young lady that jumped into the swimming pool early in her life and became a paraplegic, and now she's lived for years and years in that condition. And yet, if anybody could say would be justified in taking her own life, why, it would be her and what she's had to live. But she's lived, and you know what's kept her going? She's living for what? The glory of God. And her testimony has been fantastic around the world. for how she has stood up in having to live in a body that no longer works, has to be washed and bathed and fed and so forth, and the only thing from the neck up can she move.
She's now, the one that paints with her, uses her.
Yes, yeah, she uses her mouth to paint. Mm-hmm. Now, let's come to a passage of Scripture with the Apostle Paul. Coming to the end, I don't have the text, but I will quote it or paraphrase it. He's coming to the end of his life. He's in prison. And he says that he has a desire to what? To depart and be with who?
Christ.
With the Lord. Is that a proper or an improper attitude for a Christian?
I think it's proper.
All right. We better say it's proper. Because Paul didn't rebuke himself. He didn't think there's anything wrong with it. But he didn't take his own life. Now he said, I'm in a twixt between two things. To depart and be with the Lord, which is what?
Far better.
Far better. But I have a desire to stay and do what? Minister to you. And that is the needful thing. Now why then did he then not consume himself with wanting to die and go on and be with the Lord? Because his ministry was not yet through. His motive, Clint, is that God put him here to serve him until he was through with him. And then he would take him home to glory, and Paul later lost his head under Nero's axe. But Paul was faithful unto death. Now, why are you still here, Billy? Because God is not through with you yet. Why are all of us still here? Because God has a purpose for us to minister in some capacity to somebody. You may think that you're useless to anybody, but God doesn't think so. You're one of His children. So whatsoever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. I can't go out and do what I used to do, but I can still do something. I can still minister in some capacity. Miss Tata can still do it. And she shames me every time that I pick up one of her writings and start to read. And if I'm in one of those pity party days in which that I, nothing's going my way and why is this happening to me and this just isn't right, I can pick up one of her writings and say, my. I've got things going pretty good for me.
You know, one thing I can understand is Viktor Frankl. You quoted from him, I think, last week.
Yes, a couple of weeks ago.
If you've read his book, Man's Search for Meaning, he goes over everything he went through. He lost all of his family, were gassed, and then cremated there by the Nazis in Auschwitz. And horrendous hard work and freezing cold weather and nearly naked, no clothes. But he never lost meaning. But to my knowledge, he wasn't a Christian.
Yes.
The book certainly doesn't indicate that
he
was a meaning religious person.
So whatever meaning he found, I don't know what it was. The book may tell us. I don't know. I haven't read the book. But he came to some understanding that all of this hopeless condition, there must be some meaning to it that enabled him to endure it. Well, doesn't a Christian have the understanding from God's Word that there are no hopeless conditions? Is that we are here to serve God, and whatever set of circumstances Paul says that I find myself in, I have learned to be what?
Content
with that. Now that's Christian philosophy. That's Christian positivism. Not Norman Vincent Peale, but that's Christian psychology, Christian positivism. of knowing that all things work together for good to them who are called according to His purpose. Notice that though we are accounted as sheep for the slaughter, we're more than what?
Conquerors
through Him that loved us. How can an individual who is being cut up and sacrificed have the understanding that they're conquering? Because we can do all things through Christ who strengthens us.
Was it John Hoss that was burned at the stake?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I heard a minister preach one time about what he went through and everything and how he conducted himself. I think it was him. And it's amazing. The flames of whoever it was, I'm not sure it's us.
I believe that was us, wasn't it? Yeah.
They had green wood or something like that. It took like 5 hours for it to burn.
The wood wouldn't burn fast enough and just a horrible.
He was alive when his. One of his arms fell off?
Yeah, I think so. And yet he was singing. If it was, maybe that was another one that was singing a Christian hymn while the flames was consuming him. Let me close with this. This is a short segment here from what is called an apologetic study Bible, which I've used quite frequently. And here are the marginal reading here in under Saul states this. Suicide involves the unauthorized taking of a human life, and as such violates the sixth commandment, Exodus 20:13. God does not sanction it. The Apostle Paul prevented the Philippian jailer from taking his own life, Acts 16:27-28. But as with all other sins, with the exception of blasphemy against the Holy Spirit, suicide is not a sin that automatically excludes a person from heaven. Incidentally, I'll be speaking Sunday on the unforgivable sin or the unpardonable sin this coming Sunday. That's in the series on forgiveness. The biblical narrative record records examples of several individuals who took their own lives. In each case, the circumstances of the suicide were inglorious and regrettable. He mentioned Samson. I disagree that Samson's death was a suicide, so we won't include him. Ahithophel committed suicide after being publicly humiliated by having his advice rejected, and in order to avoid being executed for treason, 2 Samuel 17:23. Zimri, after murdering an Israelite king, ended his life to avoid being killed by his pursuers, 1 Kings 16:18. Judas committed suicide after his betrayal of Jesus, Matthew 27:5. And Saul's attempted suicide was carried out to avoid the humiliation and torture that the approaching Philistines would certainly have inflicted upon him. Here's the statement I want to give in closing. The article says, there are no biblical examples of honorable suicide. An examination of the Bible's accounts of these lives and deaths suggests two primary scriptural observations about suicide. First, it is an option that some deeply troubled people will choose when facing desperate circumstances. And secondly, it is a pathetic and tragic end to a human life. Let's close there with that this evening. Brother Jim, would you stand and lead us in prayer, please?